You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Farid. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Coming up after a brutal heat wave in Wisconsin last month, we'll talk about what climate change research says about how often the state may get heat waves in the future. First, this week we heard about a massive merger in the media industry. New Media Investment Group, which controls Gatehouse Media, is acquiring Gannett. Gannett owns USA Today and more than 100 other publications nationally. The roughly $1.4 billion deal could have some impacts in Wisconsin as well. Gannett owns 11 papers here, including the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. For more on this, we brought in Mike Wagner. He's a professor in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Mike, great to have you back.
It's good to be here.
What is going to be the combined scope of this new company once the merger is finalized?
A huge media company that will control well over 260 daily newspapers and maybe thousands of weekly papers, at least in the beginning, around the country. Gatehouse has a long history of consolidating weeklies into smaller papers or taking a bunch and making them into a couple. In Massachusetts, I think when they took over some papers there, they had maybe 50 weeklies and then brought it down to 18. So I think we should probably expect an enormous company that will consolidate in some areas, especially starting with weeklies and then by making newsrooms smaller across the places that they own.
And where in the media constellation size-wise will this merged company be?
Oh, it will dwarf the other newspaper companies by a factor of three or four, I think, in terms of, I think McClatchy will kind of be the next largest group. And now there will probably be pressure on them to think about merging with other folks in the top four or five of large newspaper owning chains around the country. And so this one will be big, and there will be pressure on other big ones to get even larger.
And in the lead up to this merger being approved, was there concern that it was going to be such a behemoth in the field?
Well, I think there's still some open questions that the Department of Justice will have to think about in terms of monopolies and in terms of kind of the regional clustering of all of the different papers that these two organizations own that now will be under one umbrella. And so I think there are some open questions that I think are unlikely to stop the merger from gaining approval from the federal authorities, but maybe thorny issues that they at least haven't seen before when engaging in a merger of this scope.
What do we know about the usual way that Gannett and Gatehouse go about reforming and putting together different resources when they do take over other outlets?
Well, on the one hand, there's some evidence in Milwaukee, at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, that the paper is often allowed to maintain some of the things that they are most well known for. The investigative work at the Journal Sentinel, I think, has remained strong since Gannett took over the Journal Sentinel a few years back. The editor of the Journal Sentinel has spoken positively about living under that ownership and has spoken positively about what's likely to come. So there are examples of newspapers getting to maintain some of what made them an attractive thing to buy in the first place. But it's almost certainly the case that newsrooms will get smaller and that the bottom line will become more important. Oftentimes, and historically, newspapers and media organizations, broadcast television, have often been loss leaders. They've been prestigious things to own because of the important role of providing information to citizens in a democracy. When large corporations take over newspapers, that mission is less important historically than the bottom line. And we see that in terms of laying off reporters, buying out reporters, spending less on resources, having reporters do more with fewer resources, having fewer editors and copy editors and things like that. So it's likely that there will be reductions in newsrooms. It's likely that some newspapers may end up folding or getting merged with others, especially weeklies. And it'll probably also, in some ways, change the shape of what the actual coverage and the quality of that coverage looks like.
We're talking with Mike Wagner right now. He's a professor in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. We're talking about the merger between Gannett and Gatehouse, which will affect at least 11 newspapers in Wisconsin. And Mike, let's talk both about what we know about Gatehouse in other situations, but also in general when mergers have happened. When those editors and copy editors get moved maybe to a regional hub, mm-hmm. what happens to local coverage? Do we see any impact?
We do. Research, I think most notably from Johanna Dunaway at Texas A&M, has found that when these kinds of mergers happen, the larger the company that owns the newspaper, the more likely that newspaper engages in coverage that is more focused on conflict, less focused on policy, and more negative in tone. And so the readers then read about a political world that has more conflict, is more negative, and is less policy-oriented. And so that can have ripple effects regarding how people perceive the state of democracy, how they think about political disputes in their own backyard. It also often means that coverage gets nationalized. There are fewer reporters to do the local hard work of local journalism and state journalism. And so it's a contributor to the increasing nationalization of U.S. politics more generally.
Do we know whether readers stay with those publications if they aren't able to get coverage and positive coverage about their local area?
Some do and some don't. Some people always want to have the local paper because they know it's the best conduit to know what's going on broadly in their community. They can carry it with them throughout the day. They can go back and check it online. It's always a great source of information. But I say always, that's probably a little too strong. Some papers have been reduced to the point where they just aren't able to provide the kind of coverage they would prefer. Not all readers stay with them, and people like quality journalism, but people also like conflict. And so some are drawn to more conflictual stories. Some are drawn to the more wide-ranging, comprehensive, complete, and more democratically healthy kind of work.
So this merger is with New Media Investment Group, which owns Gatehouse Media, acquiring Gannett. Just the fact that it is owned by this larger umbrella investment group indicates, as you were saying earlier, that there's a need to make a profit or to at least minimize losses.
Yeah.
What does that mean for the future of for-profit journalism when it is harder and harder to make a profit because the print ad sales are going down, digital is not keeping up? Is there a way to stop the losses here?
Well, I think one way to stop the losses would be for large companies' boards to demand less profit and say, we're okay with doing a little less well on the financial bottom line to do a better job of journalism. That's a less likely outcome, I think, to be frank. And so other things include growing subscriber bases digitally. A lot of newspapers are working hard to do that and realizing that advertising, which has been the traditional funder of successful bottom lines, is less likely to be the future of keeping these papers healthy. And so subscriber bases and also expanding the range of things they do. And so now a newspaper is often well known for video online and podcasts and public events. And, you know, so, for example, think of the Capital Times here in Madison, where they have the Cap Times, you know, talk. They have the festival every fall. They have lots of podcasts on their site. The Journal Sentinel has a lot of video now that they do. All the local papers basically do those sorts of things now. And so it's changing the nature of what they do, but it's also forcing that reporter to not just write the story, but then do the video and the tweets and the Facebook post and, you know, responding to readers on Twitter and all of that kind of thing.
What would you say that local news consumers can do or should do to support the kind of journalism that really speaks to their individual lives and their communities' lives?
Step one is subscribe. Subscribe to local newspapers. Use their digital footprints. Let the reporters and editors and owners of those papers know what you like and don't like about what they're doing. Interact with them online. But I would say first subscribe, then read, and then share that information with others. I think those are probably the most important things that any one person could do.
Well, Mike, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Mike Wagner is a professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison. We talked with him about the merging of media giants Gatehouse and Gannett and the possible impact here in Wisconsin, where Gannett owns 11 newspapers. And you can tell us what you appreciate about your local media by tweeting us at Central Time WPR. Do you subscribe to a local paper? Do you visit their website online? Do you get alerts through Facebook or other social media? What do you feel like you would lose if you didn't have journalists covering your local community? Again, you can tweet us at WPR at Central Time WPR, or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. Coming up, we'll look at where heat waves are expected to get hotter in the state and how much climate change will intensify them. Our colleagues at WisContext have crunched the numbers and they'll share those with us. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, President Trump is spending today visiting the sites of two recent mass shootings. We'll talk about how he's reacted to the tragedies and check up on pressure from Democrats to take up new gun legislation. First, much of Wisconsin went through a sticky heat wave last month, and according to climate change research, the state will see more of them in the future. Our partners at WisContext recently looked at how climate change is affecting the state's heat waves and how intense they'll be in different parts of Wisconsin as the climate continues to change. Keely Boltina is a host at WPR. She recently spoke to WisContext's associate editor, Will Cushman, about his latest story on this, which you can find online at wiscontext.org.
We want to talk about the latest research that you wrote about in your WisContext article. Before we do that, I think we need to understand what the heat index is. So there's temperature and then there's the heat index. Break it down for us.
Yes, the heat index is a weather indicator that uses two variables. So one, as you mentioned, is air temperature, and the other one is relative humidity. And so what is relative humidity? It's not how much water vapor is in the air. That's absolute humidity. Relative humidity is how much water vapor is in the air relative to the air temperature. And so that's kind of important because when it gets, it's a little technical, but when it gets hot out, humidity is more likely to frustrate the human body's ability to cool off by cooling. So human bodies cool down by sweating, and that sweat evaporates, cooling off the body. Humidity makes it more difficult for the sweat to evaporate, and therefore frustrates the human body's ability to cool down.
Sure. So you can't dry off as quickly. You can't cool your body as quickly. So really, the heat index is dealing with how hot it feels, not how hot the barometer, the temperature says.
Exactly. Exactly. So it could be like 100 degrees, but really low humidity, like they have often in Arizona, and it doesn't feel too bad, especially when you're in the shade. But when the humidity rises, like it does often in Wisconsin in the summer, it can start to feel really, really unbearably hot pretty quickly.
Sure. When it's hot outside, people look to the thermometer. Parts of Wisconsin just went through an intense heat wave. And it sounds like researchers predict that this is going to happen more often.
Yep. Looked at a study. What prompted this article was that heat wave that we had in July.
Everybody felt that.
Yeah. Which coincidentally landed at the same time as a report by the Union of Concerned Scientists. That's a nonprofit science advocacy organization. One of the things that they do a lot of research on is climate change. And they applied a lot of really well understood and regarded climate models, same ones that United Nations uses in its projections, looking at historical heat index data throughout North America and then applying these climate models to see what would happen in North America if greenhouse gas emissions were slowed down a lot, somewhat, or not at all. And by mid-century, it's pretty bleak in terms of dangerous heat across the nation, pretty much no matter what scenario you look at. Obviously, not slowing down emissions at all is bleaker than quick action. But yeah, there's going to be dangerous heat throughout, more dangerous heat throughout the country, including Wisconsin.
Right. And that's based off of that heat index because it's how human beings are able to function in the heat.
Right.
So where are things expected to get hotter? Are there certain parts of the state they anticipate will be affected more severely?
Yes, I would. So it's pretty related to where in the state is most affected by dangerous heat currently and historically, and that has been southwestern Wisconsin, especially the extreme southwest corner, Grant, Lafayette counties, as well as Dane County, the Madison area, Milwaukee and the suburbs, La Crosse, kind of the lower, the southern third of the state, and then also quite a bit of western Wisconsin, going fairly far north. Other areas of Wisconsin that might see less dangerous heat, but still more than they do currently, because they basically don't see any really dangerous heat. So that would be heat indices above 100 degrees. That includes the Door Peninsula and shoreline communities north of Manitowoc and Lake Michigan, as well as shoreline communities on Lake Superior, to a lesser extent, the inland Northwoods.
And a lot of people visit those places. I mean, these are famous across the country. There are people from around the world. And you're saying the calm, cooler experience that you have there in the summertime could change.
Yeah, I looked at Door County in particular because it stands out currently as historically having the fewest number of days with heat indices above 100 degrees. I was looking at data from the CDC. They maintain heat index records from 1979 to 2011. And in that 33-year period, Door County recorded just one day in a really intense heat wave in 1996 that killed hundreds of people in Chicago and Milwaukee. Just one day during that heat wave rose, the heat index rose above 100 degrees in Door County. That is expected to change by mid-century, even with pretty aggressive curbing of emissions. Door County could see 2 days a year of heat indices that high. And that's two days a year, not just 2 days over a 33-year period or something like that. And that's, again, on average. But yeah, by the end of the century, with no action, Door County could see a week or so of really dangerous heat.
Will Cushman is the associate editor of Wiscontext. And we're talking about high heat in Wisconsin now and the potential for more of these high heat waves, the combination of high temps and significant humidity that makes it really dangerous for people just to be outside. And Will, I think we should talk about that. I mean, what are we talking about when we say dangerous levels of heat?
Yeah, that kind of it totally depends on who you are. So it's interesting. The CDC defines dangerous heat as heat that is so dependent on air temperatures and humidity that make it significantly warmer than it otherwise would in an area. So dangerous heat in Wisconsin might not be the same thing as dangerous heat in Texas, just based on what we are familiar with. It also depends on the population. So the elderly, very young, individuals with mental illness and chronic diseases are more at risk for heat-related health problems. But yeah, dangerous heat in Wisconsin starts around 90 degrees heat indices. Certainly when it goes above 100 degrees, that is definitely dangerous to pretty much the whole population.
And you say the whole population, but I think some people, specifically with certain jobs, have access to air conditioning or at least cooler places in a way that others don't. How do we know how the heat levels interact with different people doing different things across Wisconsin?
Yeah, that's really important. Like, for instance, right now we're in a really cool studio, even
right,
though it's pretty warm outside. That is not the case for the state's farmers, people who work in the timber industry. I looked at a study that said that farmers, people in the timber industry, anglers, and other people with outdoor jobs.
Construction
mm-hmm. workers, yeah, account for a large proportion of people who get sick related to heat on the job.
Some climate researchers talk about this concept of a warming hole, and I want to make sure that we get to that. Explain that to us, especially that's not a term many people are familiar with right now.
Yeah, and I wasn't super familiar with it either, but this is based on a study that came out of UC Davis last year, which noticed that the Midwest generally has not seen an increase in daytime high temperatures during the summer like a lot of other regions have. That doesn't necessarily mean that heat indices, so what we feel, the heat that we feel hasn't been getting warmer. In fact, it looks like I looked at two different data sets for heat indices, one from 1970 to 2000, and then another one from the CDC one from 79 to 2011. And there definitely was some warming. Every county in Wisconsin saw a little bit more, one or two more days of dangerous heat per year. And most of that is based on higher relative humidity, it seems.
The article that you've written really looks at this idea that there are some scenarios where there's a greater risk of high heat more often and some scenarios where it's backed off a little. And it is pretty gloomy. At the same time, you reference a scientist who is able to tell us, you know, this isn't necessarily the worst thing in the world. We can affect it, right? Give us a little bit of hope here.
Yeah. So that's kind of the danger with any conversation about climate change is that it can very quickly get into doom and gloom.
Because so much is happening right now and it's so hard to roll it back.
Right. Yeah. And it's important to remember that these projections, they're based on really sound science, but they're also projecting out like 50 to 80 years. And there are a lot of variables at play. And the most major, the largest variable that we can impact is emissions, greenhouse gas emissions. And so, yeah, Rachel Licker, the scientist, senior scientist from Union of Concerned Scientists that I spoke to, who coincidentally is a UW-Madison graduate and very familiar with Wisconsin, she did strike a hopeful tone when I talked to her that our communities and nations will be able to curb emissions at least by enough to maybe not make the most dire projections bear out to reality.
People still have some control.
Yeah. Yeah. There is still some control for sure.
Will, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Keeley.
That was Will Cushman, associate editor of WisContext. He spoke with WPR host Keeley Boltina about how climate change may be bringing more heat waves to Wisconsin. To read more about the story, you can find his piece online at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, Democrats are putting pressure on Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to take up new gun legislation. We'll find out where that effort stands during our look at the week in Washington. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll get the latest on a spill at a frac sand mine in Jackson County from WPR's reporter in western Wisconsin. First, we're taking a look at some of this week's top stories in national politics. President Trump is visiting El Paso and Dayton today after this weekend's mass shootings in those cities. Meanwhile, Democrats are calling for the Senate to reconvene and vote on gun control legislation passed earlier this year by the House. Our question for you this week, what new laws regarding guns do you want to see Congress pass, if any? Do you think there's anything that could realistically make it to the president's desk? Are there other measures related to mass shootings you think need attention? And how would you judge President Trump's tone and statements in the aftermath of these two shootings? Let us know by calling 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Amanda Turkel is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Since the last two shootings, Democratic lawmakers have been pressuring Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to call senators back into session to take up gun legislation. Here's a listen to Minority Leader Chuck Schumer appearing with Republican Congressman Peter King.
We're saying to Leader McConnell, do the right thing. Gavel the Senate into an emergency session so we can take immediate action on the bipartisan, already passed gun legislation that Peter and others successfully shepherded through the House of Representatives.
How much pressure is there being exerted right now, Amanda?
There's quite a bit of pressure on Mitch McConnell. I mean, the Democrats have stood together and pretty clearly said, look, the House, which is controlled by Democrats, has passed background check legislation, which would close a couple loopholes so that people who buy guns at gun shows and on the internet wouldn't be able to get around background checks. And so it would close that loophole. And Democrats are saying, we passed this in the House. Now it's up to Mitch McConnell to bring the Senate back and do it there. Mitch McConnell has given no indication that he is going to do that. Instead, he has said that he has asked three of his top committee chairmen to look into bipartisan solutions. It's not clear what that is, but so far he doesn't seem like he's going to pass the legislation Democrats passed.
If he did decide to bring the Senate back into session, what would that look like? Is there legislation ready to be debated and voted on, or where would they be starting if they did?
Well, there would be the House legislation that's already passed, so he could take that up. Again, he doesn't seem like he's going to do that. So we don't know exactly what the Republican chairman are looking at right now. Trump has said today that he would be supportive of some sort of background check legislation. You know, Trump changes his mind a lot. And when he gave his speech on Monday, he didn't talk about background checks at all. And then previously he tweeted, I believe it was a tweet, he said that he would be interested in background checks tied to some immigration legislation so he could push through his immigration agenda. And then you would also get background checks. And I don't think Democrats would be interested in that at all. So it's not clear what Trump will actually support and where Republicans will go. But there is pressure around the country. You know, after these recent shootings, three recent shootings, people want to see something happen.
And the House is also on their break. Has there been any talk of them coming back in response to these shootings?
There was a little bit of talk of whether they should, the House should come back and do more, but House Speaker Nancy Pelosi sort of put a stop to that and said, look, we already did our part. We passed legislation strengthening background checks. And so she wants to keep the focus squarely on Mitch McConnell rather than coming back, passing something else, and sort of muddying the conversation a bit. So their line is, we passed this, now it's your turn.
Let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. And Nick in Beloit is up. Hi, Nick.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What would you like to say?
I think right away we need to finance metal detectors. We can start with schools. Obviously, that'd be a good place to start. You have a single entrance metal detector there. Maybe we need them in all public buildings. I know it's a lot of money. But we spend a lot of money on military equipment that, you know, isn't really going to fight this enemy. We want to protect our country, so that's what the military is for. Well, we got to start protecting me when I go to Walmart today and my daughter and my unborn grandchildren. That's one thing. Obviously, we can't be selling military-grade things to people. None of that at all. And if you want to buy a gun, let's put you through some of the measures we put people seeking an abortion. Let's put you through some of the things, watch a video, give you maybe a mental test, blah, blah, blah. There's quite a few common sense things, but these families whose lives have been destroyed, they need to see something done. Maybe it isn't going to work, but it's a multi-level solution. And I think one of your other questions was, how did we feel the response was?
Yes.
My God, what is a sign of really kind of not caring or paying attention? Did anybody mention the city of Toledo in this?
All right. Thanks for that, Nick. So Nick brought up a lot of other measures, both things like metal detectors, but then also, for instance, it sounded like a ban on assault style weapons. Amanda, what types of of gun control or legislation are even being talked about? Are some still totally off the table?
I mean, you know, bans on assault weapons being talked about, it's unlikely that will pass. That seemed to be a more distant measure. The other thing that's being discussed are what's known as red flag laws, so that if someone is deemed to be a risk, officials could temporarily take away their guns. And that seems to be getting some support, not only from Democrats, but also from Republicans. And, you know, the call to do something is also just not coming from Democrats. Susan Collins, a moderate senator from Maine, said she wants to close loopholes in background checks. There was Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania, who, of course, teamed up with a Democratic senator, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, for stronger background checks. He would like to see more done. Mike Braun from Indiana wants to see red flag laws. So, you know, I think people are feeling the pressure on this.
We're talking right now with Amanda Turkle. She's Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. We're taking a look at some of the biggest stories out of the state, nation's capital this week. And President Trump is visiting El Paso and Dayton today. And even before his arrival, leaders in those cities were having very mixed feelings about him coming. What were we hearing from them?
There were protests, first of all, greeting Trump. People lined the streets, and there was one of those baby Trump balloons mocking him when he went to Ohio. But you had Senator Sherrod Brown, who initially said he was not going to meet with Trump and not appear with Trump when he visited, but he changed his mind and decided to and said he wanted to talk to him face to face. And later he and the mayor of Dayton held a press conference and said, like, Trump needs to end his divisive sort of hateful rhetoric. But a lot of officials, Democratic officials, also spoke up, including in El Paso, and said that they just didn't want Trump to come at all. He has not helped the situation. He has fanned the flames of sort of this hatred and bigotry, and they just didn't want him there. But he decided to come anyway. And he did not allow reporters in what's known as the pool to come along and take pictures when he was at the hospital, because he said it wasn't a photo op. But interestingly, just a few minutes ago, his team was tweeting and sharing photos and video from it. So he didn't want the press along, but he sent out his own pictures.
There was actually a message from some of the healthcare workers in El Paso who were treating the victims from the shooting, saying that they did not want the president to come. What came of that?
I mean, you know, he is, so I don't believe that Trump has done his El Paso visit yet. He has done the Dayton one. But, I mean, right, there's, you know, a lot of people, we heard in Dayton that a lot of people, they may not agree with Trump, but they wanted to respect the office and so maybe didn't speak up. Again, the press was not allowed along on these visits, so we don't know what was said. But he's definitely getting resistance. There are, you know, some of the people who he will be meeting with are fans of his, but there are a lot who aren't. El Paso is, you know, a little bit different than Dayton because the shooter, the alleged shooter, seemed to be more specifically targeting Latino members of the community. And that's a community that Trump has really targeted with his rhetoric. So I think there is maybe more sort of raw emotions there toward the president.
Joan in Eau Claire is on the line. Let's go there. Hi, Joan.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
It's really unfortunate. It's very unfortunate that so many of these politicians that we have allow themselves to be owned by the NRA. The NRA contributes to a lot of political campaigns. And, you know, so there's a great effect on elections with that money. And so then these elected politicians are very compromised when it comes to any kind of legislation that would come across their desk with regard to gun control legislation. I think it's a travesty, and I do know that there are parts of the country where you, if you sue a gun company, which you can't even do in Colorado, but if you sue a gun company and you lose the suit, then you are required to pay for the law costs, the legal costs of the opposite side.
All right. Thanks for that call, Joan. And Amanda, it certainly is true that the NRA has been a very powerful lobby in Washington. It's also a very interesting time because the NRA in some ways is in quite a bit of disarray with its leadership. Do you feel, Amanda, having watched a lot of these politicians in the past, Is there a little opening here for politicians to maybe inch a little closer towards gun control than they might have felt comfortable doing before?
There definitely is. And I think that is going to be an interesting point. You know, the NRA after these mass shootings is usually pretty quiet. And then they wait a few days before they come out swinging. And, you know, like you said, the NRA, though, right now is in disarray. They're facing, you know, people in their leadership resigning. They're facing investigations into their finances, their rank and file. Staffers and some of their members are incredibly unhappy at the way they've spent their money, you know, lavish spending on people at the top. So, you know, what I'm going to be watching is how the NRA reacts after this shooting. Are they too unorganized to really regroup and mobilize as they usually do after mass shootings? You know, are politicians feeling more emboldened now? I'm not sure. I think it's a little too early after the shooting, but certainly sort of anti-gun and gun control advocacy groups are feeling more emboldened. They have more money. They have a lot of people on their side, specifically young people who have been mobilizing. And I think, you know, politicians are feeling that they can just speak out against the gun lobby a little more.
We're talking with Amanda Turkle. She's Washington Bureau Chief at the Huffington Post, and we're discussing some of the week's top political news. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see lawmakers do on the issue of guns, if anything? If you do want new legislation, are you hopeful it can happen, or are you discouraged? How have you felt about the tone of remarks by President Trump and others in the wake of the recent mass shootings? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our talk with Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief at the Huffington Post. We're looking at some of the week's top news in politics. And Amanda, last weekend you were at the Public Service Forum hosted by the Public Employee Union AFSCME. You interviewed 19 of the Democrats running for president, and the shootings actually happened during that event. Can you talk a little bit about how they responded?
Sure. It was a little surreal because I was on stage basically for about 6 hours with one break. And, you know, I didn't have my phone, so I wasn't really getting information. And then someone off stage passed me a note that there had been a shooting in El Paso and that there were 18 people shot. And I didn't know what that meant, if they were dead or if they were wounded. And then Beto O'Rourke came on, and it was the first public comment he made about it. And he was incredibly emotional, holding back tears, you know, talking about what the community meant and what was going on. And his remarks were just very, very raw. And then we, instead of talking about the labor issues we had planned to be talking about, we obviously talked to him about what could be done on guns and things like that. And then he immediately, he did talk to the press afterward and then immediately canceled the rest of his events for the day and went back to El Paso. And, you know, he's still there and he is no longer going to the Iowa State Fair as planned because he's focusing on his community in Texas. And then throughout the day, the candidates came on stage and all of them gave remarks about it. And that was largely how I got my information through the day as the death toll went up. And, you know, it was pretty shocking and horrifying to hear what was going on. And then to, you know, candidates talked about not only what to do on guns, on white nationalists, white supremacy, and things like that. So it, you know, we still talked about labor issues at this forum, which was supposed to be the focus, but you couldn't ignore what was going on in El Paso.
Sure. And how much variation did you hear between these different candidates on the issue of guns and things like white supremacy?
I mean, I think where you had the candidates agreeing is that something needs to be done. You know, stronger background checks is something they agree on. And that, you know, not every candidate called out Donald Trump by name, but, you know, there is a consensus in the Democratic Party that, you know, President Trump's rhetoric has divided people, that he has encouraged some of the worst instincts by people like these white nationalists, you know, and on Twitter and things like that. And since then, you know, you've heard people, I think, call Trump out more forcefully on Monday, his speech saying that, you know, we have to reject hate, we have to reject bigotry and white supremacy. Just felt pretty hollow considering a lot of what Trump has done and how he launched his campaign in 2016 and sort of how he conducts himself on Twitter. And so I think you're seeing candidates, you know, pretty willing to come out and talk about him, as you saw Joe Biden today doing a speech.
Let's go back to the phones, and Charlie in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question for your guest is the following. Several presidents in the past have generated so much animosity that it seems like they were the only ones who could actually do major things. I'll give an example. Only a anti-communist like Nixon could have gone to China, and only an anti-Russian such as Reagan could have gotten the nuclear arms deal that was signed at Reykjavik. I guess my question would be, isn't Trump the person who might be able to get a gun control law finally passed because of the animosity that he just drive within the United States?
Thanks for that call, Charlie. And Amanda?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. You know, of course, the question is Trump going to really do anything? But yes, if Trump suddenly had this sort of change of heart or decided that he's, you know, so outraged by these shootings and actually wanted to push for background checks, stronger background check legislation or something like that, you know, he has such a committed base of supporters that I think that he could get it through. You know, Mitch McConnell is going to, I think, listen to him. You know, again, Trump has not gotten into specifics, so I don't know if he's actually going to do that.
We're talking with Amanda Turkle. She's Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. We're looking at some of the biggest news stories out of the nation's capital this week. And at that AFSCME forum that you're at, Amanda, obviously unions have been seen as a real backbone of the Democratic base for many, many years. This was a labor organization. And what were some of the main issues that seemed to be at the forefront for union members in this election coming up?
Well, we solicited, not only did the other moderator and I question the candidates, but we solicited questions from the AFSCME members because we wanted to hear what they were concerned about. And just the big concern is, one big concern is healthcare, in other words, student debt. But a lot of them just wanted to know, are these candidates going to protect unions? You know, I think there's a feeling that, you know, obviously President Obama was a friend to unions, but he didn't always talk about unions as much as they would have liked. You didn't hear him use really, really pro rhetoric and give pro union speeches all the time. And that is different than what's going on now in the 2020 race. Candidates are incredibly pro union. You're hearing them talk about unions and the importance of the labor movement all of the time, even the more moderate candidates. And, you know, every one of the candidates stood together at the forum when we asked questions and wanted more collective bargaining rights for public employees and things like that. So I think there's a lot more agreement that unions are important. And, you know, right now, obviously, they're all competing for the endorsements of various unions. In 2016, they came out and endorsed Hillary Clinton pretty quickly instead of Bernie Sanders for the most part. This time, they are waiting to see because their members are a lot more divided.
And briefly, in other news, the president signed a federal budget deal late last week. Usually, I think this would be bigger news, but there's been a lot going on. Can you tell us a bit about what ended up in the final deal?
Sure. It's a two-year bipartisan budget deal. And basically, it means that there won't be, you know, we won't hit the debt ceiling and create this economic crisis for the country. And it seems more likely that we won't have the government shut down in September as we've, you know, had to deal with before. So it raises the spending $320 billion over current levels. It lifts the debt ceiling for 2 years. You know, so there was some grumbling about the fact that it's a two-year deal, which means that the next president is going to have to deal with the debt ceiling, which is always the point of negotiations of, you know, is one party going to hold it up to try to extract concessions from the other? And this kicks it to after, you know, if Trump loses, it kicks it to the next president, which could be a Democrat, and a Democrat could have to deal with it, for example. So, you know, and importantly, it ends the sequester, which was supposed to be this thing to get parties to work together and come up with budget deals. But it you know, it didn't actually work. And all it did was make sort of severe budget cuts. And I think everyone's happy to see that over.
And who do you think came out as more of a winner, Democrats or Republicans?
You know, this is certainly good, I think, for Republicans because the Trump administration, Trump was lobbying for this. They don't want to deal with the debt crisis. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, Democrats are happy the sequester is over. They don't want another government shutdown. So I think a lot of people were just happy to move on with this. There were some Republicans who didn't vote for this because they didn't like the fact that it didn't cut down on spending more often. And again, there were some Democrats too who weren't too happy with it.
Well, Amanda, thanks as always for joining us.
Great. Thank you.
Amanda Turkle is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. She was with us for a look at the top political news this week. You can still weigh in on whether you want to see action taken on gun control at the federal or state level. What would you like to see? You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. The September 2018 cover of Vogue was a portrait of singer Beyoncé, and the photo was taken by photographer Tyler Mitchell. That was the first time that an African-American photographer's work was on the cover of that esteemed fashion magazine. And now a year later, that image has been acquired by the Smithsonian National Portrait Gallery for its permanent collection. The museum tweeted, "We're just so crazy in love with her that we had to do it. We look forward to adding this new work to our collection." Central Time producer Rachel Vasquez is a big Beyoncé fan and joins me in the studio. Rachel, what is it about Beyoncé and this image in particular that's inspiring?
Well, I think that Beyoncé in general in this picture takes a great photo. She's beautiful and radiant as always. I think what is inspirational about Beyoncé to me is her honesty. I think an album like Lemonade, where she talks really openly and honestly about infidelity and the pain that that caused her, took a lot of strength and courage to do. So that's what I love about her.
If you're in D.C. when it's on exhibit, are you going to go see it?
I will be the first person there.
Well, that's great. You'll have to report back from live from yeah. The National Portrait Gallery. Thanks, Rachel. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll discuss what we know about a frack sand mine spill in west central Wisconsin as the state DNR continues its investigation into what happened. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.